And today we're going to be talking about how we come into this world. And some sort of, we're going to start with some fairly deep questions, actually, like where does memory begin? Where does consciousness begin? Because as therapists, actually, it's quite important to consider these questions, like how far, for example, does memory go back? Because does memory depend on the nervous system? All these kind of questions. So just a bit about my background. I've been working with babies for many years. I started getting interested in this work in my 20s, actually, when I got involved in body psychotherapy, and particularly primal therapy. And some of you might be familiar with that. It was started by Arthur Yanoff in the States. And sort of, he took a lot of his stuff also from Wilhelm Reich, who was also passionate about working with babies. And so for me, this interest really stemmed from that time when I began to notice some patterns in my behavior seemed to originate in very, very early experience. So it's been a kind of a lifelong journey, you could say, for me, both as a therapist and both personally. And realizing over years that a lot of the things that really shape us start incredibly early, certainly in the womb, quite possibly before, and certainly in the first year or two of life. So I just want to kind of look at some of the influences that kind of create us who we are. And when we think about that, we often, you know, in birth psychology, we tend to talk a lot about kind of trauma and kind of look at the negative side and the difficulties. But actually, there's so much that we bring in and that creates resilience in us and strengths in us and our quirkiness of characters that make us who we are. So it's not all bad. And I want to really look at it from the point of view of resilience, because resilience and adaptability, I think, is so important, particularly now, and particularly for our children, I would say. So I'm going to start just by sharing a little PowerPoint that I have, and we can have some questions. So please do put anything in the chat as you want to. But I thought we could just start perhaps with a little bit of settling time. And because when we're working with anybody, when we're working with adults, when we're working with babies, when we're working with mums, it's all really about relationship. Obviously, there's a lot we can do physically. You know, we can help a baby with its digestion, with colic, with all kinds of stuff. But primarily, it's about a relationship, and it's about creating safety in that relationship, both mum and baby. So I thought we could just start by a little bit of settling. And one of the things that's really nice to do with this work is just to be able to kind of settle into our heart. And I know for people right now, this can be a little bit challenging because our heart can be feeling all kinds of different kinds of pulls right now. You know, it's not for a lot of people. And I think particularly for mums with newborns certainly the mums I'm seeing at the moment who are pregnant, there's a lot of different challenges going on, which are quite difficult. Particularly, I would say, around isolation, you know, mums having to give birth without partners there and having to go with scans without partners there, these kind of things. So it's a very, when we rest in our heart, you could say it's quite a vulnerable place right now for a lot of people. But that's kind of where we connect when we're working with mums and babies. So if we were to spend a little bit of time just maybe, if you want to close your eyes just for a sec and just feel into your heart field, and just without any kind of judgment about what that feels like, whether that feels right now open or it feels a bit vulnerable or it feels closed, whatever, it doesn't matter, but just to feel into it. So one way of doing that is to feel the kind of physicality of the heart. Like you might be able to feel your heart actually beating. You might feel, well, hopefully you will feel this beating, but sometimes we're not aware of that. But you might feel the heart as being warm, maybe, or not. But it will certainly have a quality to it. Or it might have a quality of vulnerability to it, or a strength to it, whatever that is. So if we just feel that quality of it without judgment, and maybe we can also feel within that a kind of an energetic field around our heart that is kind of it expands. I mean, it expands a long way, but certainly very strongly about a foot from our body, sort of front, back, and side to side. And you could say that's kind of what babies relate to in us as therapists or mums or dads or whoever it is. And you know, here we're not just talking about babies, we're talking about everybody. Actually, everybody relates to this. And so the more we can kind of settle into that heart space, that the more we can kind of connect. So that energetic field is often felt around about a foot or so. And maybe you can be aware of that in yourself. And again, the quality of that will be very different from person to person. For me, I can feel it as a kind of warm holding space that's also very open and quite vulnerable right now. So as you feel into that, maybe you just allow your mind to settle into it, into that space. And imagine maybe that you have someone with you, a loved one or a baby or whatever it is, child, and you're relating to them from that space. So not from your head, but just from that space. And just see what that feels like. For me, that feels very open. And perhaps as we sit here together, and obviously we have people joining us from all over the world in these webinars, we could just feel into the, or allow that heart space to go out into the wider world. And it's quite interesting that as we do that, we can often feel the wider field of the people here. And when we're working with families, certainly as we do that, we can feel the family field, and we can feel the kind of quality of the people around us. So again, that's a very lovely way and a containing way of working with this material. And it's a very supportive place, and it's a very safe place too, which is of course very important, is what babies relate to, what we all relate to. So perhaps as we sit with that, we can then just slowly bring our attention back to our heart field and to the physical heart, if you like. And then just, it's quite useful just to be able to open our eyes and just to orient to where we are in the room. So we kind of know where we are. That's also a very important thing, that we know where we are. And you might want to take a breath. Very good. Okay, so I'm just going to show you a few images, and we'll start with this, and please feel free to ask any questions as we go through. And I'm just going to start by sharing my screen. Lisa, it's saying, can I share? Am I allowed to share my screen here? You might have to make me a...
That should work now. Does it work now?
Try again. I'm not sure what's going on there. Let's try again. Okay.
Is it working now?
Yeah, cool. What are you seeing there? Can you see my screen all right?
No, not actually.
No?
No, I wonder why.
Huh. I do apologize. I'm not doing this from my normal computer today. So, nothing.
No, not yet. You definitely do have the rights to now.
Okay, let's try it again. Sorry, I do apologize. Okay.
Yeah. I'll make you the host just in case.
Okay.
In case that makes a difference.
Sorry, do apologize.
We usually test beforehand, don't we?
No.
Because it was us, we didn't think we would need to.
Right, sorry, it's taking me to this. It's taking me to some privacy settings for some reason.
Okay. Your host now perhaps if you just try again as the host.
Oh, it's saying, oh my God, it's saying I have to, hang on, let's try it again. Okay, try it now.
There it is. Perfect.
Yeah, you can see it now.
Thank you everyone for your patience.
I do apologize, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Great, sorry. We normally get this right earlier on. So first impressions, how the way we come into this world can shape our adult experience. So we're going to start with some big questions, which is basically when does life begin? So this is, you could say this is a philosophical question, one which has been the debate of many a philosopher over the years. And when you look at this picture here, this is from Lennart Nielsen's book, A Child is Born, which actually came out in 1965. It was a really landmark book. These wonderful images. So a lot of people might think, okay, so life begins at the moment of conception, or it begins sometime in the womb, or it begins at birth, or whatever our belief is, or that perhaps it starts at sometime before that. Now, if you look at this image here from his book, where we have this kind of continuity of consciousness, you could say, and certainly this is what Jaap van der Waal talks a lot about, is embryology as a continuum, really, from the moment of conception or even before that through to death. We're continually evolving, you could say. So in this continuum here of these pictures, we don't really know where things like consciousness begins, memory begins, where life begins. But most of us have a feeling, and certainly young children have a feeling, of that they've come from somewhere. And Jaap talks a lot about this as well, that we have this sense that perhaps we've come into this world, into this physical body, and often with a sense of purpose. Most people feel that they have a sense that they've come to this place, to this world, to do something, to achieve something. If you talk to most people, they will feel that. And so Jaap talks about how when you talk to a young child, they will often say, or they'll often ask the question, where did I come from? Mummy, where did I come from? And then the answer is often, well, you know, mummy and daddy loved each other so much, and you know, you grew in your mum's belly and then you were born. And of course that's not the answer what children want. Like and often when when, say, a family member dies, say a grandmother or grandfather dies, the child will often ask, where did, you know, Uncle Terry go? And there was this sense of continuity, like, have we come from somewhere and we're here and then we're going somewhere else? So, and I think that kind of feeling is worth remembering when we're dealing with babies and with everybody. So when does experience begin? So this is something else. And when does a sense of me and other begin? And again, this is there's a lot of debate around this. If you look at the literature and the understanding from a psychological point of view, some people will say that young babies aren't really be able to differentiate out a sense of me and other. And I personally don't think that's true at all. It's very, very clear that even in the womb, babies seem to have a very clear experience of self in quite a sophisticated way and a sense of other. In other words, for experience to happen, there has to be an experiencer and an experience. So a sense of I, an I consciousness, you could say, and a sense of something else. So the question is, when does that arise? And the other question is, so how do strong embodied experiences shape who we are and how we relate to the world, particularly when they're pre-verbal? Now that's very interesting because a lot of people have very strong experiences in the womb, which are very difficult to kind of rationalize. You could say that we know that early experiences are often to do with survival, and they're very embodied and very almost on a cellular level, you could say. So when those experiences are pre-verbal, they're much more difficult to articulate later on, or perhaps even understand. They're much more of a felt sense. We might have a felt sense of belonging in this world or not. I know several people, some of my friends, who actually have this sense that they don't want to be here at all, that they never wanted to be on this earth, you know. Or they might have other feelings that, for some reason, they might feel resentment towards the world or whatever they are, whatever these experiences might be. But these kind of pre-verbal feelings, we don't really necessarily know where they came from. And they're very difficult to sometimes be with because they're pre-verbal and they're difficult to articulate clearly about why do we feel these things. A lot of people feel stuff that they have no idea why they feel them. So, and some of these experiences might be very physical, emotional, spiritual even. Again, there's a wonderful book around this. I think it's called Life Before Life, which was a whole series of reports of regressions. It was done by a psychotherapist. Sort of looking at people's feeling of why, what was their experience before they were incarnated, even before they were conceived, actually, extraordinarily enough. So a lot of us hold life statements as we come into this world, and some of those are formed in the womb, and perhaps even before, certainly at birth, by the kind of experience that we have at birth. So the other question is trauma necessarily bad? And I think I touched on this earlier, that definitely not. We tend to think of it as a negative thing, but actually it's not at all. Most of us, probably all of us, will experience some kind of trauma in our lives. And a lot of that is probably early, and quite a lot of that we probably don't even know about. And that's what creates our resilience and our character, you could say. But it's very much how we're able to deal with it at the time, how held it is at the time, and whether we can kind of hold it in some sort of meaning. And I'll talk a little bit about that. This whole thing about being able to add meaning to an experience is very, very important for all of us and for babies particularly. Is choice important? Do we really have choice? And again, that's a very interesting question. So And I've looked at this actually, if you look at the kind of birth journey, in quite a lot of cases, you could say that that choice is taken away. And I know a lot of people talk about, you know, do we have choice around incarnation? Did we choose to be here? And some of us perhaps feel we did, and some of us didn't. But choice is very important as an adult, isn't it? Like we like to feel we have choice around things. And when we don't have choice, we feel we can feel all kinds of stuff. You know, we can feel resentment, we can feel anger, and all kind of these things. But so if you look at it from the point of view, say, of someone who's experienced IVF or something like this, where perhaps implantation is assisted by the use of certain drugs and things like this, perhaps around the time of birth, inductions were used. And that's an interesting thing, where babies appear to determine when they want to be born. There's a certain protein in the lungs, for example, that's released when babies are ready to breathe. So that you could say there's a kind of choice around this, that once babies are able to breathe, they then release, or it seems to start this whole cascade of labor. So again, if a baby's induced, then again, that choice is taken away. And I work a lot with babies who are induced, and they can often be babies who are quite difficult to settle. I mean, there's reasons why that is, because induction is pretty hardcore. You know, it puts a lot of stress on mom, and it puts a lot of stress on baby, because everything's very fast. Everything's speeded up, and baby tends to kind of come into contact with bony parts of mum's pelvis, which are pretty uncomfortable, in a kind of much harder way than would be normal. So there might be all kinds of reasons why babies who are born this way might be difficult to settle. But again, I think that in my experience, there can be things like perhaps resentment when choice is taken away. And something we need to look at, and that can maybe go back very early. And certainly we see that in babies as well. Do we choose to embody? What's it like when choice is removed? And we kind of touched on that a little bit. When does memory begin? So, and this is a very interesting question. And does it depend on having a nervous system? This is a big question, because most people would assume that it does. And when you look at when does a nervous system that is able to remember things physically develop, that's quite reasonably late. It seems that babies in the womb seem to be able to remember things really quite specifically, even when their nervous system is very underdeveloped. So again, we had on our platform, on our e-health platform not so long ago, Pim van Lommel, who's a cardiologist who's done a lot of work with near-death experiences, for example, where people are clinically dead, so they're brain dead, and yet they still seem to be able to remember things, yes, and observe things and hear conversations and remember them when there clearly isn't a nervous system. So what about things like near-death experiences? His video is very interesting, and we have it on eHealth Learning if you want to have a look at it. That was with Pim van Lommel, who's written a book about it. So these questions, when we're looking at experience, whatever point they happen, these questions are very important, because in my experience, you can be working with babies who have, it seems like, had a really, really difficult time. You know, maybe there was some trauma in the pregnancy, maybe they had some horrendous thing happen at birth, and you think to yourself, my God, that baby must be really traumatized. But it's really all about, it's all about meaning, context, and whether something is contained. And then whether something is contained in the bigger family field as well as within the baby. So, and the, can the experience be integrated? That's really important. So when you look at this, I've got this up here because it's just showing you the way that our nervous systems actually work. And our nervous systems work in terms of, you can say, contextualizing things, particularly in terms of previous experience. Now, so all our senses do this. Our eyes, our ears, our sense of smell, our taste, our sense of touch, right? We are constantly referring back to earlier experiences to put meaning into any experience. And we do that for various reasons. One of the main reasons we do it is to see if something, an experience, is safe or not, or how we need to respond to something. So this, from this very simple experiment here, if you look at these three lines, and we're obviously using our eyes, so this is an optic experience. The top line looks like it's going from light to dark, right? And the middle line looks like it's going from dark to light, and the bottom looks like it's going from light to dark again, yeah? I think most people would agree for that, except that that's not true. That isn't true. This is an optical illusion, because if you look at the lines and you look at the top line there, that is going from light to dark. The middle line is exactly a same shade of gray, right? And the lower line is going from dark to light. But the way we see it, because we're looking at the other two and we're contextualizing it, the way we see it is not accurate, you could say. It's an interpretation, and it depends on previous experience. If you look at this one, again, this is a more extreme version of this. If you look at the squares of A and B, however much you look at that, you think that those squares are different shades of gray, don't you? And they're not. So those shades, those squares are exactly the same shade of gray. And if I take them out as a screenshot, that's what they look like. And however much you look at that chessboard, you'll still see it like they're different, but they're not. Yeah. So it's all, when we have any kind of experience, it's all about context and meaning. And this is the same for babies. If you look at that, it looks like it's moving, but it's not, right? Because again, it's to do with expectations and meaning. So this is just something that I've come up with. It's not so much the experience itself that has the long-term effect. It's the context and the meaning in which that experience is held that is important, right? So in other words, we can't assume when we're working with babies, because they've had a particular experience, that they will respond in a particular way, or that it was necessarily overwhelming. It's all about the context and the meaning. So this is why it's very important to encourage mums, I think, to talk to babies and children about what happened even very early on, so they can put it into some sort of context and meaning. You know, myself, I had to have a very early operation when I was 3 months old. And the way that was handled was there was no explanation about that situation. So there was a lot of shock in that experience because there was no context and meaning to it. The meaning was impossible to find. So I created meaning, and babies do this. We will create meanings around experiences in order to make it, hold it in some sort of context. And some of the meanings that babies will attach to experiences are often not actually true. So they might feel that they've been abandoned, but perhaps they had to go into hospital because mum had to take them to hospital and there was some life-threatening thing that they had to go through, some operation or something. But if it's not held and it's not explained, then babies will tend to make up meanings, if you like. And so it's very important to try and get mums to talk and dads to talk to babies and children to explain what happened and why, and label them to create some sort of context and meaning around it. How do experiences in the womb affect us? So this, again, we tend to look at negative things, but there's a lot of positive things, positive emotions and healthy environments. We can focus on those. We can also focus on stress. There's so much research around this or particular stressful events and how they might affect babies again. Again, in terms of what we can encourage for mums in pregnancy is a lot of support, as much support as possible. And we know from research, I think the research has been done to show that if you can support mums during pregnancy and in the first year, I think they say that for every dollar you spend on that, you save like $7 later in terms of, having to support mums. Expectations, ergonomics, we can also help in terms of good posture, pelvic position, all this kind of things as well. This is one of the cartoons I had done for my book, Choices in Pregnancy and Childbirth. And this, I really love this actually. He says he found him swimming in the cosmic ocean of infinite possibilities and unconditional love. And the cartoonist was really brilliant at the way he got those characteristics of the parents there, being completely nonplussed about this. But, I think it's really nice to, when we're working with babies, that it's so special. We don't really know where they come from. We don't know what their life is going to be like, you know, and we can help so much. Bessel van der Kolk also says, it's not what happened, it's the residue of the imprints left behind in the hormonal and nervous system. So again, he's saying it's not actually the fact of what happened, it's how it affects the nervous system. And certainly from my point of view, I've tracked this a lot in my own nervous system, and certain things that happened that I know about in pregnancy, you know, those before I was born, and certainly in the first year of life. And what got me interested in this work in the first place actually was looking at my own reactions and my own nervous system and how it responded in particular ways, and how I would go into states of overwhelm quite easily in very, very particular situations, along with freeze. So that we're talking about kind of a sympathetic activation of overwhelm, and freeze, which is more of a parasympathetic thing, where my, like, I would my mouth would like go completely dry and I would not be able to speak, and things like that. But it was in very, very specific circumstances which got really me interested in this. So what's it like when whole societies go through a similar experience, or a particular kind of traumatic event? Because again, different babies and different adults will experience this in different ways. So similar experiences or traumas such as separation or things like circumcision. So in certain societies, you get, say, pretty much all males are circumcised on day 10 or whatever it is after birth, for example. Or when I was born, this was in the 1950s, all babies were separated from their mums at birth and put in wards. So you'll get everyone in that society will have had pretty much the same experience of separation. This is a really interesting picture from America, but it was very similar in the UK, actually. I love this picture. I don't love it. I mean, it's horrendous, but it's like showing these lines of cots in this hospital. And the fact that mums and dads could view their babies through a glass screen at particular times of day. So And this used to happen for, yes, certainly when I was born, through the 50s and probably 60s, that babies were routinely separated in this way. And therefore, one might be able to say that this certainly would affect relationships later on. So this is this can, abandonment anxiety early in life can create patterns of merging into lack of boundaries. And without boundaries, there's no sense of self. And if there's no sense of self, there can be no relationship. That's quite harsh. Invasion anxiety results in defensive behaviors that create distance and numbness. And certainly in my experience that, you know, I can recognize some of those patterns in terms of relationship. When we look at the physical impacts of pregnancy and birth, obviously we're looking at how the baby lies in the womb, how it might be shaped. So this tree is from a picture I took in Cornwall. There's a lot of wind in Cornwall. It's on the western side of England, you know, if you're familiar with that. And so I love this picture because it's extremely beautiful. And in the same way that you could say that babies might experience these kind of adaptive patterns by how they're born or how they're lying in the womb. In this case, this is shaped by the wind. And so, but it's at the same time, you could say there's extreme beauty in that pattern. There's nothing wrong with that. This is an expression of adaptability and resilience in my view, and it's extremely beautiful. So when we know that, you know, the way babies lie in the womb, we know for a fact that, you know, we're not lying straight. There's a kind of twist in us, like we have a shortening through one side, you can see here. And that can result in certain postural and so-called abnormalities or characteristics, you could say, as we grow. And depending on what kind of position we are in the womb, will depend a lot on those kind of patterns that will be reflected through our neck, through our pelvis, through our back, etc. The bottom right there, where it says exceptional, that is what we call a back-to-back or posterior position in the womb. That's pretty uncomfortable for a baby to be in for a long period of time. It tends to create a lot of compression in the base of the occiput here. And it's also pretty uncomfortable for the mum because babies tend to come up against the top of mum's sacrum quite hard. So not a particularly comfortable position to be in. And so even in kind of an optimal position, which is called a left lie position. I think you can kind of see that there. That's top left, excuse me. Left occipital anterior, which is a kind of the easiest position or the best position for a baby to be in. And still you can see there's some twisting going on. There's some lengthening through one side of the body, a bit like a banana, you could say. And that can result in those kind of pelvic tilts that I talked about, which is this kind of patterning is very, very common in the general population, actually. We see it a lot. And those kind of rotational patterns as well, you can see that from the way the baby's lying there, sort of an anterior hip on one side and anterior shoulder on the other side. Very common. Now, this is a nice picture of butterflies. Now, I was thinking about this a while back, that when any thing comes into existence, into form. And this is not just humans or mammals. It's also true of insects, it's true of birds, and it's true of things like seeds and plants and trees. So we all go through various stages of compression. For the human being and probably a lot of mammals, you go through a period after conception where you've got you know, the outer shell of the egg, and at some point that this the cell division begins to become too much and has to expand out of that. And certainly at birth, if you look at, again, all creatures, at as they come into existence, into the world, will go through this extreme compression. In this case of the butterfly, the chrysalis will contain it and contain it and contain it. And then at some point it'll break free. So this is also true of birds in an egg. It's true of babies and mammals as we come down the birth canal. This is intense kind of squeezing of our structures, and then this expansion. So we have to ask ourselves, why is it that all creatures and pretty much everything that comes into existence goes through this process? There's probably a reason for it. Nature usually does things for a reason, you could say. And of course, for some babies, the way we're born, it doesn't go through that process. And I'll talk a little bit about that before we stop. But mostly, the forces that are involved as we come into existence are compression, a lot of compression, actually. You know, some of the cranial bones even, you know, overlap each other, as we know. There's a, if you see some of those pictures, which I'll show you, there's a, it looks like the, everything is squeezed. And then we have this expansion in craniosacral and cranial osteopathy. It's called ignition. There's an ignition that happens in the expansion, from the compression to the expansion. And that is to do with, actually, they talk about this ignition happening in the fluids of the body. That term ignition, interestingly, came from a lot of the old cranial osteopaths were working around the time of the development of the car. And, you know, in the old days when you used to crank a car or you turned the starter motor and the engine comes to life. So that's how they kind of saw it, everything coming to life. So expansion, and we have in terms of humans, we have a lot of rotational forces and torsion. For a lot of other mammals, that doesn't necessarily happen. We're one of the few mammals that actually has to rotate to come down the birth canal. And that can create all kinds of torsion patterns in the head and the neck and things like that. Also dragging forces. If you think about it, as you come down the birth canal, there's like a lot of dragging kind of forces that come down through the body. Yeah. And then you could say that tractional forces or pulling forces are not normal, right? You don't see these kind of forces in other animals. And the tractional forces might be applied through things like suction and forceps, certainly in cesarean sections when the baby's pulled out. And I'd like to talk a little bit about this because these forces are very unusual. So you could say that the compression, expansion, rotation, dragging kind of forces, the body is designed for, but tractional forces are not. So they have a particular kind of ramifications for when we're working with babies. This is a very nice picture. A lot of these older pictures of pregnancies show these images really nicely. This is where you can feel, you see the babies all crunched up there. A lot of pressure on the baby's head through the top of the cervix there. And then as the baby comes down the birth canal, you can see there the baby is coming into contact with the mum's sacrum, pretty much here in terms of where the baby will feel it there. And then, of course, there's a lot of rotation that happens as the baby comes down the birth canal. And then you get a lot of these dragging forces to do with the baby face coming into contact with the sacrum, like, again, these kind of forces down like that. And again, this picture really illustrates that really nicely, that it's not a very comfortable process. And again, one could say, well, why does nature design something which is so difficult? And there's all kinds of reasons for that, possibly. And certainly it creates resilience, you could say. Oh yes, that's our friend Angela Merkel. Here now, if you look at her face there, you can see that she has quite a lot of asymmetry, and most of us have asymmetry in the face. And she has a lot of asymmetry and lengthening through her right side there. And this is what we generally see in faces. When we look at them, we can usually pretty much see how they were born, to be honest. So you'll often notice that one eye is slightly lower than the other, perhaps further back. The jaw is longer on one side. We can see it in this picture as well, where although he looks pretty good, his left eye is a lot lower than his right, and it's slightly smaller. His nose is deviated to one side, and he has a lengthening through the face. So you could see quite clearly the way he was born was there was more dragging through this side, and pushing over with his jaw. His nose would have come up against the mum's sacrum, and his eye would have been lower on the left because of the dragging forces through the birth canal. And of course, babies have many more bones than us as adults. That's not really true. It's just that they're not so articulated. They have a lot of gaps in them. As we know, we've got the fontanelles, and even bones like our occiput are in several pieces. In fact, the occiput, which is normally one bone in an adult, is about four in the baby. So they have about 350 bones when they're born. And a lot of them fuse later on. So this is a baby's occiput, you can see here. The back of the head, this is. And you can see there's some interesting gaps here. That the flat bit there is the back part of the head. And then underneath, it's sort of looping down back where it articulates with your atlas and the top of your neck. So you can see that front part where it says basilar part is the front in front of your spinal cord, you can say in the brainstem, and that articulates with your sphenoid. And either side, you've got this articulation with your neck. Yeah, and you can see that in there's a little, those blue bits are more cartilaginous, you could say. So there's a lot of scope for kind of distortion patterns being held there in the occiput particularly. That's why as cranial therapists, we tend to do a lot of work around there. And again, the sphenoid at birth, this is the bone that forms part of the back of the orbit of the eye. This is why you could see those differences left and right in the eyes there. But the sphenoid bone is in at least three parts in the baby, for example. And you can see all those kind of fontanelles, those big gaps there. And again, depending on how baby's born, how it lies, baby lies afterwards. These days, babies tend to spend a lot of time on their backs, which is not very great for the back of the head here. And you can get all kinds of distortion patterns, like plagiocephaly, for example. And then when you come to forceps, this is an old picture. Forceps were brought over to the UK, apparently, by the Huguenot brothers. And they were kept very secret, apparently. They were so secret, they were actually kept in a box and only brought out almost under the cover of darkness. But forceps particularly have these very strong, they have compressive forces around the ears, but also very strong tractional forces. So tractional forces are interesting. Sorry about these pictures, but they will show you some of the forces involved through the ears around. You can see on the bottom right there, the compressive forces around the ears. And on the left, bottom left there, you can see a case where a suction cap has been used. And so these kind of forces, what tends to happen is that the body will go through a whole cascade of one thing is resistance. And you see this in babies a lot, that as any kind of pulling is made on the baby's head, on the neck. And again, this happens in cesareans. You see pictures where most babies are brought out from here. So from here as they're brought out. So what you'll generally see is that the babies will tend to kind of do this kind of thing, right? So there'll be a resistance, partly because the structures that instinctively we need to protect in ourselves are the brainstem, because that's involved with a lot of vital functions, and our abdomen. So you tend to get this contraction through the psoas and contraction through the neck in these situations. That's one thing that happens. But also, you can get more kind of distortion patterns fed into the body this way. And particularly the images that we saw before of the occiput and these various bones of the cranium, how they can get quite a lot of grief, you could say, or distortion patterns fed into them through this. Okay, so I'm going to open up for, we've got about 5 minutes left. I was going to open up for any questions before we finish. So I'm just going to stop sharing for a minute. Have we got any questions at all on Facebook? Oh yeah. So Mary was asking, if we're speaking about safety in the womb, could this be a reason why a baby goes into breech and comes out double folded? I think there's all kinds of reasons why babies might go into different positions, including breech. I'm not sure it's necessarily related to safety, but safety in the womb is very interesting. It's something I've worked with a lot myself, actually, and babies can feel, I know it sounds strange, but can feel quite unsafe in the womb, and that might be because is a baby wanted, and was a baby expected, for example, was there an attempt at termination even or previously? So okay, any ideas around opening bowels before birth, baby subsequently swallowing meconium? No, I don't. I mean, I could ask my colleague Lena Clark about that, but that's not something that I can give any advice about, really, I'm afraid. Seema's asking about a vacuum extraction. Yes, so vacuum extraction is one of my, I was going to say passions, but it's one of the things I'm very interested in terms of the effect of it, because vacuum extraction or Von Tuss was, I think it came in probably in the 70s, as far as I understand. And this is where they apply a suction cap normally to the occiput, the back of the head. And so it's a very local kind of pressure. And then they'll apply suction so that it sticks to the back of the occiput, and then apply traction. And so it has a particular effect, I would say. What they say is that, when you could saw that image of the forceps, those forceps apply a lot of intracranial pressure because there's a lot of squeezing going on. And one of the things they say about Von Tuss is that it creates less intracranial pressure and therefore it's so-called safer. But because it's much more local pressure, it actually creates much more distortion through the cranium and the occiput. So, I think if you can avoid suction, that it would be, it's very good. And if you get to see a baby and who's been through suction, I would always palpate around the back of the head, because you could often feel quite a lot of distortion around here, around the base of the occiput. If you just put your fingers back there, you'd often feel that there's a lot of kind of torsion patterns, because if you imagine those forces are really strong and they're all fed right into the base of the occiput and right down the spine, actually. Penta, know about a village in Africa where the girls are taken out into the bush for circumcision, thinking about the trauma and adult lives also in regard to giving birth themselves later. Yeah, there's a lot of people working with this, actually, Penta. I can give you some links to that information as well. Okay, so any last questions before we stop? Oh, there's a Q&A thing here too. Fiona's asking, so a near miscarriage could result in an anxious baby, child, or an adult. Yeah, again, this, if there's been a previous miscarriage, obviously mum can be quite anxious around that. How much a baby will be in the womb will be aware of that is difficult to say. My feeling is probably yes, but mostly it'll be around how anxious a mum is around that, for obvious reasons. And babies will feel that, because they feel everything. So there is some thing going on there for sure. Yeah. Great. Tony, would you say there were recognizable personality features or psychological symptoms associated with different parts of birth and gestation experiences? That's a really good question, Tony. Thank you. And, you know, some people say there are kind of people develop life statements around particular kinds of births. And I don't actually know if that's true. In my experience, everybody is very, very different. And I don't really think that you can say that there are personality features associated with particular kinds of birth. I think it's a very, very individual thing. But amongst some birth people, they will say, well, for example, if you were, you were cesarean, for example, and you didn't really have to struggle to get out of the womb, you might have this kind of belief that, you know, if you're in difficulty, someone will, in your adult life, someone will come and be there to help you out. That kind of thinking, I don't think is particularly helpful or necessarily true, to be honest. But it's an interesting question, and it might, you know, that there probably is some similarities in that, how we were born. excuse me. So Alison's asking, in the UK, what decade did they introduce chemical induction? I'm afraid I actually don't know that. I mean, I think it was quite a long time ago. Someone else might know the answer to that, that question. And in some countries, it's routine. Like they use it a lot in France, for example. And again, it's interesting to look at different countries. They have very, very different experiences. So for example, in Brazil, we know there's like something like 90% of babies are born through cesarean. In France, most babies are induced for some unknown reason. I don't know why. Good. Great. Any last questions before we stop? Anything you want to add, Leisha?
Hi, no, I didn't think so. Although I was just really interested in the way that you were reframing trauma experience.
Yeah.
In terms of it being an experience rather than necessarily more than that, or well, just the image of the tree really struck with me, and I haven't heard trauma be framed in that way yet.
Yeah, I think it's very important for us as therapists, because otherwise we tend to assume, this is something that happens a lot, you know, when we first meet a family and we maybe talk to mum about what happened in the pregnancy or the birth or the first year, whatever it is. And we hear, sometimes I hear really terrible stories. And then you immediately have this assumption that this baby must have been really damaged somehow. And you can see that's absolutely not the case. And you have, because this baby is really doing well. And that partly it's often because there's a very good relationship between mum and baby. Like mum feels, or baby seems to feel really heard by mum. You know what I mean? There's a sort of like a, it's a way of holding experience, I would say, that the baby feels that experience has been held. And then you get other babies who have kind of, they might have had a nice, a so-called nice natural birth. Everything seemed to have gone fine in the pregnancy. And yet they're angry. They're not sleeping well. You know what I mean? And you think, well, why is that? Why is that? And again, I think it comes back to a lot to this whole thing about how we put in everything into context and meaning. I think it's really, really important thing to understand. And that how any experience that we have can be kind of turned round. I mean, some experiences are incredibly difficult to hold in that way. But most experiences can be turned around into a positive thing, actually, and actually create a lot of internal strengths going forward. And I think it's one of the things that I like to stress, really, because mums so often go into feelings of guilt that they could have done better for their child, you know? Mm. That's not really very helpful, because it doesn't actually help communication between mum and baby either. It just pushes back mum into shame and guilt, and that's not a good place to be. So I think it's very important to stress when you're working with mums and babies the positive side of what happened. You know, there's always positive sides of what happened. So great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So Lisha, can you remind me what we've got next? So next week we have, I'm in conversation with Joanna Waters on.
Yes, and it's called Welcome Reality.
Wonderful. And then the week after we have Mia Khalaf, and Mia is going to be talking about, what subject is that, Lisha?
Healing birth and pre-birth.
Wonderful. And she's running a course, isn't she, on that as well? Yeah.
Yes, in March.
Great. And on Sunday, I will be talking to Anna Verwal. That's a question and answer for you to bring your questions to. Anna is a wonderful birth educator and midwife based in Holland. And if you haven't looked at her TED talk, please do that. She's on, if you just look up Anna Verwal birth on TED Talks, you can find her there. So we're doing a Q&A session at 10 a.m. on Sunday morning, if you want to join us for that. Great. Cool. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.